Good morning and welcome to the February 3rd edition of Mountain Money. I'm your co-host, Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Kevin Kennedy. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Roger. Good morning, everyone.
It is a disturbingly warm day here in Park City. You might not want to get out in the slush, but if you don't choose to ski this morning, we think we have something that'll keep you interested. We're going to start this morning by speaking with Professor James Chappell. He's the author of Golden Years, How Americans Invented and Reinvented Old Age.
Well, then we'll play our discussion with Professor Paul Argenti from the Tuck School at Dartmouth about corporate communications relating to the recent ski patroller strike and the fallout at Park City.
We had to terminate that interview in progress when we played it a couple of weeks ago in order to cut to the live coverage of the inauguration.
And then we'll finish the hour with Alejandro Laverde, who will tell us about Encanto Restaurant and Colombian cuisine.
All this and more this morning on Mountain Money. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Mountain Money. The great philosopher Groucho Marx once said, getting older is the problem, you just have to live long enough. But the reality is that aging in America is, and always has been, a challenge. And the way this country has addressed the issues surrounding aging has evolved substantially over the last century. Professor James Chappell has taken a deep dive into the issues surrounding aging that this country has and has not, addressed in his new book, Golden Years, How Americans Invented and Reinvented Old Age. We're lucky to be joined by him this morning. Good morning, Professor, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Professor Chappell, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
Well, what motivates any book is a hard thing to say. I was raised in Central Florida, so I was always surrounded by older people. But then I was turning 40, my parents were getting older, my grandparents were still alive, and I was watching my family deal with these issues that so many millions of American families deal with. And, you know, as a historian, I wanted to think, okay, what's the history of this? And The book I wanted to find hadn't been written, which is basically about what's happened in the past century. What have we done? What have we not done? How have we, as American society, grappled with this problem of social aging?
You divide the book into three parts, tracking the evolution of how aging is treated in this country. You label part one the ages, and it tracks the period from 1900 to 1940. Let's talk a little bit about how you would characterize the experience of aging during that period.
Yeah, so this is... The book begins in the early 20th century. So there have always been older people, but it was in the early 20th century, it was the first time that people said, whoa, there's a lot of old people, and this is some kind of social problem that we need to somehow address using social policy. And so the first few decades, this is the progressive era. This is the time that the government is trying to solve lots of problems about sanitation and public health and education and things like that. Old age is one of those problems. And so in the first few decades of the American discussion about aging as a social problem, we really get an idea of older people. They were usually called the aged or the aged and infirm. And it was a really negative depiction because the whole point was this is a needy population. They need help. They need pensions. And eventually they need Social Security. So if we're thinking about the last century of American discussion of aging, we start with a period of a very stigmatized portrait of age, but for a good reason, because that stigmatized portrait was designed to convince people that, well, these people need help. These people need Social Security.
And what was going on before? In other words, was the previous model one of sort of multi-generational homes that was starting to change?
Yeah, so there's a lot of myth and romance around what aging was like kind of before Social Security. But in general, a lot of our preconceptions are true. Like older people did tend to live with their kids. This was not always a happy arrangement. You know, most of America was rural at the time, and so older people tended to be the property owners. And so there was a lot more intergenerational living. Now there were a lot more kids and a lot fewer old people, of course. And so most kids are not living with their parents, but most parents are living with their kids. In the early 20th century, this starts to break down for a number of reasons, especially during the Depression, when families can't afford to have old people around anymore. And the economy is changing and becoming more urban and more industrial. So the old model of older people as the landowners living with their kids kind of falls apart in the early 20th century, which is why we have to come up with new ideas and new models.
And one of the fun things about the book is you sort of talk about different interest groups or different organizations and the roles they played in sort of pushing social mores. Can you talk a little bit about the Eagles and how they differed from the Ex-Slave Pension Association in terms of the vision they had for the kind of support that should be added for the old, for old,
yeah.
For, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, one of the things I wanted to do in the book was say, okay, there's this new social problem that's being discovered. Who are the people who are first talking about it, and what are they saying? And in the period before Social Security, there were two big movements. One was the Ex-Slave Pension Association, as you mentioned, which was really an organization about, okay, which older people need the most help? That's the big question, and there's two big answers. The Ex-Slave Pension Association says, well, let's look at the formerly enslaved. Like, they worked for decades for nothing. And now they live horrible lives. I mean, if you were a 70-year-old slave in 1915 or a formerly enslaved person, your life is terrible and you need lots of help. And so the Ex-Slave Pension Association said, all right, we're going to have old age policy. Let's make old age policy that is responsive to issues of race, issues of American history and disenfranchisement and things like that. That's one model, which I think is the path not taken. The other model comes out of the Fraternal Order of Eagles, which is it's like the Elks, or it's one of those kind of fraternal associations that matter a lot in the early 20th century. And they say, well, who needs the most help? And they say, well, it's our members. This is a largely industrial, whites-only organization. And they said, let's make old age policy around the needs of working class whites, especially in cities, formerly industrial workers. And that vision of who needed help is the one that survives into Social Security. So Franklin Roosevelt was a member of the Fraternal Order of Eagles. Some of their people are present when Social Security is signed. And so I really wanted in this first part of the book to give a sense of there were other paths for American aging policy that would be more anti-racist, more inclusive, more equitable. Those were not taken. What we got instead was a different kind of vision focused on the white working class.
So the Eagles idea was did not include agricultural workers or anyone who is not middle class white.
They would not say it as explicitly as that.
Of course
but
not.
In practice, it was a whites only organization,
yeah.
And it was mainly in industrial centers. And the whole idea of how Social Security was funded was, I mean, as you know, with your Social Security checks today, I mean, you pay a certain amount out of your paycheck. And that only made sense for the class of workers who were getting regular payroll with taxes deducted, which is really only kind of white collar or industrial workers. Farmers, domestic workers, almost all work that women did, service workers, were not part of that system. And so they're really thinking about industrial workers or white collar workers, most of whom, and you know, this is Jim Crow America, almost all of those are white.
So how important was Frances Townsend in the creation of Social Security?
Yeah, so there is another, so coming after the Eagles and the ex-slave pension folks are around World War I. In the 1930s, in the lead up to Social Security, so there's about a 5-year period between the beginning of the Great Depression and the passage of Social Security. One of the big puzzles of this whole period is, like, Social Security is Roosevelt's primary domestic accomplishment in response to the Great Depression. But what's weird about it is that it has almost nothing to do with the Great Depression. Like, it's not an obvious solution at all to issues of mass industrial unemployment. And so the question is, well, why does he put so much capital into old age pensions and Social Security? And a big reason is there was this movement called the Townsend Movement, which it's kind of forgotten now, but it was as big as the Civil Rights Movement 30 years later. This is millions of older people, especially in the Mountain West, actually, who were in Townsend clubs and wrote letters to Congress. There were millions of letters, and it was this kind of crackpot scheme that would have, basically what it did was give every older person in America, totally universal, it would have given them thousands of dollars a month that they had to spend. And so it was like a UBI for older people. And the idea was, if we get older people to spend like crazy, it'll get us out of the Depression. And so it's this utopian scheme. It's this kind of like formerly socialist physician from from the Midwest who comes up with this idea. And the idea sort of catches fire. Roosevelt has to respond. All the people in the Roosevelt administration are like, we can't do this. This is a crazy idea. You know, and unlike the president 100 years ago, the government didn't just do crazy things. They had to have plans for things. And they came up with Social Security as something that could actually be fiscally sound, which it has been for the last 90 years.
Well, okay. Now, talking about the Social Security, how did that impact the potential for absolute independence for America's elderly?
A huge amount. I mean, one of the arguments in the book is that before Social Security, old age as we know it, as a period of life that is about kind of leisure and rest and retirement, doesn't really exist. It exists for some, like, wealthy people or whatever, but for a regular middle-class person to be able to expect, I'm going to get some kind of retirement financing, and there can be some period of my life of retirement. That doesn't really exist until Social Security. It's passed in 1935. It takes a few years to go into effect, and that's why we don't really get a retirement culture in this country, like retirees, old people magazines, the AARP, all that stuff. That's all post-1945. And it's because Social Security has created this new class of older people who have something in common, which is that they're retired.
And that's sort of a natural segue to part two of the book. And Kevin and I are both laughing because we both want to ask the same question. In part two, the term senior citizens begins to replace the term the aged. Tell us the significance of the change and what did it indicate about how society's attitude was shifting?
Yeah. So I talked before about how the idea of the aged, and if you look around Social Security, the images of older people are, from our vantage point, very stigmatizing. It's about, like, people starving in the street with their hat in their hand. After 1945...
Hey, Sarah, what are you doing this Friday?
Whoops, sorry about that.
That's okay. And after World War II, you get all of these people who have income, and they don't want that image. They want a positive image for themselves. And so they start to call themselves senior citizens, which to us now, it sounds like almost a joke. Like, it sounds like an old-fashioned kind of term. But to think historically for a second, go back in time, you know, post-war American history is all about who can claim citizenship. The civil rights movement is completely about that. The feminist movement is completely about that. And what's the idea of a senior citizen was we older people, we seniors, we're citizens too. And we can do everything that citizenship entails. We can contribute to society. We can be active and engaged in society and things like that. So even though senior citizen, like, now it sounds like a joke about, like, 10% off your bus pass or whatever, at the time it was a really kind of revolutionary idea about claiming a powerful and active identity for older people in this country.
Instead of being the aged as a nobody expected to, you know, if you're done with work, you're not going to live for, you know, 3 or 4 years. They now have citizenship.
I'm a senior citizen.
Yeah, yeah, and things to do.
So how did the notion of the centrality of the nuclear two-generation family limit the relevance of senior citizens? This was something that was really interesting in the book.
Yeah, so this is a kind of a fun part to think about. I think it has a big impact. You all asked earlier about independence. So if you think about post-war American history in general, like, you know, a lot of your listeners probably watched 50s, 60s sitcoms like I did. I watched Nick at Night growing up or whatever. And all of those shows are about the two-generational family. Those are about the nuclear family, the Leave It to Beaver family or whatever it is. And the reason is because after 1945, American social policy was organized around the two-generational family unit. That was the whole point, was we're going to create powerful families with male breadwinners and stay-at-home moms. That's the answer to communism. And something is left out of that story. There's been a lot of attention over the years to the fact that, like, gay people are left out of that story and people of color are left out of that story. It's a very kind of exclusionary model. But in a way, the group that's most clearly excluded is the grandparents. Mm-hmm. And so what this post-war cultural move is doing is really saying grandparents and older people are not part of the family, really. They're kind of outsiders. And popular culture says that. Psychologists and psychoanalysts were saying that. There was an idea that if kids are too closely tied to grandparents, it's going to mess up their development. Like, think about a movie like Psycho, which that's the basic message of a movie like Psycho is, you got to the grandparents cannot have a role. You got to detach from the grandparents. And I think this has a big role, both positive and negative, right? The positive role is older people want to be independent. They don't really want to live with their kids. They want to have active lives themselves. But it also created a kind of exclusion, which I think has had a lot of negative consequences. Like, think about housing policy. What was being built in this period were single-family homes. And that has a lot of impacts down the road, because now when older people want to live in, you know, with their kids, you have to build an ADU in the backyard, or they have to buy a house nearby or whatever. And that's because of a bunch of policy decisions after World War II were all about two-generational families. And it makes intergenerational thinking and living a lot harder, which is why even now, you know, it's intergenerational living is the norm historically, but now it seems like kind of weird or shameful or something like that. And that's because of this kind of Cold War celebration of the two-generational family.
Right. So now, what are the forces that led to the passage of Medicare?
Yeah. And so it's exactly what we're talking about here, because if you look at the who supported Medicare, a lot of times Social Security and Medicare get derided as like old age special interest politics. That's not really what's happening. What's happening is middle-aged people are worried about their parents' health bills destroying their own family. Hmm. And so it's young people who are pushing for Medicare, because after World War II, something else that's happening is this the birth of the modern hospital system as we know it. Like X-ray machines and like huge, it's really the 1930s, you still have got doctors going door to door with a little bag. After World War II, you got expensive hospitals. And now if grandma falls and doesn't have health insurance, that can really impact the life chances of grandma's kids and grandkids. And so this whole idea of creating senior citizens as an independent class. And so you think about this notion of independence. Independent from whom? Independent from their kids. Mm-hmm. And so the purpose of Medicare in the long history of American family development is to give older people the capacity to remain economically independent from their kids, even as their health starts to decline. And that's what Medicare is supposed to do.
And one of the themes that comes up a few times in the book is sort of exemplified here by the nature of the Medicare benefit and its limits. The Medicare benefit was really for an acute sort of kind of medical intervention, a hospital stay, a doctor's visit, as opposed to looking at the longer term issues that so many of older people face with disabilities.
Yep. Yeah, so this is one of the more tragic parts of the book. Historians can often be pretty gloomy people, but in general, I think I wanted to write a basically optimistic book about how many challenges we've faced with older people in the last century and how well. But around this specific issue about long-term care and disability, I think it's in a major problem. It's probably in lots of listeners' lives, in the lives of many people that I know. Older people in America, if you're healthy from 65 to 80, you've got a good life. You got good Social Security payments. You can keep working. You can do what you want. Once your health starts to decline, you're in trouble. Because when these systems were set up, they were thinking about able-bodied, healthy people. Medicare provides acute care. There was nobody in 1964 when people were debating Medicare. There was no one there who was a representative. There was no disability rights movement. They were not thinking about 85-year-olds. They were not thinking about nursing homes. They're thinking about healthy 70-year-olds. And that's had a huge impact on American life over the past half century, because those people who are frail 85-year-olds have always been an afterthought. So the reason why so many families are scrambling to care for these 80-year-old relatives is because the government hasn't helped. And that was a policy decision or a policy oversight. That's why so many millions of us right now are in this really difficult situation.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm going to jump to part three. of the book. So we're looking at 75 to 2000. And what was the role of, I'm not going to say the American Association for Retired Persons because they don't use that acronym, just That's the right. AARP in defining senior citizens as older people. So a new term.
Yep. So, you know, and this I've learned even since publishing the book that this is a pretty American phenomenon, that in Canada, people still talk about senior citizen is still like that's what people use. But not in this country. I think that now that has fallen away. And now we're meant to refer to older people. And so that's what people say now. That's what, you know, probably that's how I naturally speak. It's the kind of politically correct term now. And it has always been the preferred nomenclature of the AARP. So the AARP really emerges as the juggernaut of old age organization in the 70s and 80s. They never liked the idea of the senior citizen. They always saw it as stigmatizing. They always thought, why say the 65 plus population is one thing? We should recognize that aging happens across the life course. We should refer to older people, and that should be a very fluid category, which for them really means kind of like 55 or 50 and up. And so I think in the last like 40 or 50 years, in the age of the AARP, we've kind of stopped talking about older people as a specific interest group of 65 and up people, and more about a much bigger and more amorphous class of older people that, and the main goal has not been to improve their policy outcomes, but to improve like their cultural image and to fight against ageism and things like that. So if in the first two thirds of the book, we're fighting for social programs for those 65 and up, in the last third of the book, it's about fighting to improve the image of those 55 and up with the Senior Olympics and the Golden Girls and things like that.
So 55 and up is older people. We have a bike race here in town, and the people over 55 who do unbelievable times blows me away.
I know. It's incredible. Yeah. I mean, so like the Senior Olympics start in about 1980, and I remember watching them when I was growing up. And those are usually for those either 55 or 50 and up. And it's part of this new kind of cultural attitude of like you just said, let's be amazed by what older people can do. Let's be amazed by their capacities. And that's been like the dominant kind of cultural narrative in the last 40 or 50 years. On the one hand, it's great, right? I mean, I'm getting older. I want to access a vital, healthy, active bike riding image of old age. But the problem on the other side goes back to what you said before, is the more we focus on like 57-year-old skydivers, the less we're focusing on 87-year-olds in nursing homes. And yeah. I think that's been the kind of dangerous part of this cultural shift.
We need to wrap up, but I want to, having spent time with the book, and I know how much time you've spent thinking about it, what are the changes to existing policy that you would advocate for the future?
Yeah. That's a great question. You know, as a historian, I'm blessed to not really usually have
to answer that.
Everybody asks me, so I feel like I should have something. You know, a couple of things. One is, I mean, Social Security is in trouble. This is the most dreary part of this, is that Social Security is going to run out of money in 8 or 9 years. Everybody knows it. The problem is not that hard to fix, but nobody wants to do it because it's going to be a little bit expensive. It's unpopular, et cetera. And to me, that's like so pathetic. Of all the things that our government is currently doing, one thing we could be doing that would improve so many lives so much is just to fix Social Security. The bills are already there. The other thing I would really like to see is a real addressing of the long-term care issue.
Oh, yeah.
The population of the 80-plus is going to explode in the next 40 or 50 years. And we have a choice as a society. We could enter a world where long-term care is about well-paid nurses in well-regulated, beautiful nursing homes. That is one choice. Or we could be in the world we're in now with it's part of the Medicaid, the welfare system. They're horribly trained. They're non-union staff, all that stuff. And that's a policy choice we're going to make in the next 10 or 15 years. And I hope we make the right one.
The book is Golden Years, How Americans Invented and Reinvented Old Age. Professor James Chappell, thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for drawing attention to these important issues.
We'll be right back after this. The news stories surrounding the patrollers' strike and conditions at Park City Mountain during the holidays were everywhere. There's no question that the 2024 holidays left a black mark on the reputation of the resort, on Vail, and probably on the town as a destination itself. So what, in the first instance, could Vail and the resort have done better in terms of handling the situation? And more importantly, what kind of damage can a situation like this do to the various brands it issues, the Park City Resort, Vail, and the town itself? We're lucky to be joined this morning by Professor Paul Argenti of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth, the man who literally wrote the textbook, Corporate Communication. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you. Good to be here.
You know, we could start with the beginning of the strike on December 27th, but do you have any observations about how Vail and Park City handled things in the run-up?
Yes, I think they did a pretty bad job, to be honest with you. I mean, for one thing, you know this is coming. It is what I would describe as kind of a predictable surprise for a company. And given that that's the case, you know, your communications should be much more transparent and honest, and, you know, you need to have open communication channels. And instead, from what I could see, there isn't a whole lot of communication out there. The only thing that they did was to stress that, you know, wages have increased more than 50%, which, as someone who comes out there in the winter, you know, with my family for skiing, that is appalling. That means they were paying $12 an hour to the people who literally save your life. So I don't think the communications ahead of time did them any good, let's put it that way.
And are there strategies that they could have employed that you've seen other companies who see something ugly coming have done? Is there a way to have done it better?
Yeah, I mean, let me tell you something. Union communications is not like something new for people to learn. It's something that you could plan for. And as I like to say to my students, these kinds of problems do not have to happen. The best way to prevent this is never to let it happen in the first place. And some good examples, and I was trying to think of examples in the hospitality industry for you. Last year, you know, Hilton Hawaiian Village had a whole contract negotiation. And the village successfully concluded a strike by ratifying a new contract. And throughout that process, I'd say Hilton did a really good job of engaging in dialogue with union reps, keeping employees informed about the developments. And that kind of proactive strategy really helps to reach an agreement down the road. San Francisco hotels, I spent a lot of time in San Francisco, so I was aware of this. At the end of the year, a lot of hotels, including Hilton, Marriott, and Hyatt, were involved in labor negotiations, and they employed good communication strategies with public statements, outlining their positions, what they're doing to make it happen. And then we could go back, you know, this goes on, like Marriott in 2018. I think this kind of communication is one that you could get right pretty easily. You know, it's not that complicated.
And so what should they have been saying? Give us a hypothetical press release that Vail should have put out in early December to sort of let the public know what might be coming.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, they should say, you know, we want to do everything we possibly can to make these people happy and to try to reach an agreement that makes sense for us and for them. And we are bargaining in good faith and doing the best that we possibly can to make sure there's no disruption on the mountain and that our employees feel happy to work for us. Something along those lines, like a sign of good faith. Instead, at least from what I've read, you know, and this could be the association making stuff up, but I doubt it, that they instead threatened retaliatory measures against striking employees, including deactivating passes, threatening eviction, ending dependent employee programs, cutting health benefits, locker room access, terminating daycare services. You know, this isn't the way that you treat people. And if, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. If that was in the air, that probably was the kind of communication they were getting from people in management.
That's who the patrollers were getting? That's the information the patrollers were getting?
No, that's the kind of information, yeah, that the public was getting.
The public, yeah. About how they were treating the union and the patrollers. Gotcha.
And again, if you're planning, there's an expression in town of the $10,000 or the $20,000 vacation. You know, we're in early December, the people have planned these vacations. They don't have any information about what's coming. So I guess part of what happened here was the surprise for the vacationer.
Yes. In fact, and that's a really important point, that they could have easily written to people and said, you know, we are going through a tough situation, both in terms of the snow and the work, you know, the union negotiations, and you should be prepared for this. We're happy to give you refunds. I mean, I know they would have taken a financial hit, but actually the benefit of that would have made up for any financial hit that they would have taken from that. And I think, you know, it strikes me that their lack of communication since then, and particularly given that there are some lawsuits from people who were upset about what happened show that they're adopting a more legal strategy and still not realizing how important it is to, you know, get to the bottom of this and try to make things right with your employees.
You know, given how many, I don't know how attuned you are to the way that Vail approaches its pass sales. They sell, obviously, you know, thousands of season passes under the Epic Pass program that are good at many resorts. One of the things I was wondering why they didn't do was send out something that say, hey, we may be having a problem at Park City, but we can happily accommodate you at any of these other fine resorts in North America.
Exactly. I mean, had they any kind of communication strategy or any sense of what good communications to customers is all about, they would have done that. And, you know, the problem is, at this point, you have a duopoly, you know, in the industry. And, you know, they just don't care as much about trying to please customers in the way that they should. I mean, going there myself, it is super expensive to go there. I think one of the picketers had a sign that said, you know, you pay $25 for a hamburger and you're worried about spending $23 for the people who are going to save your life on the mountain, which is absolutely true and heartbreaking. It's ridiculous that this company didn't handle this better. It's ridiculous that they didn't take the time to try to figure out how to make sure that their customers were taken care of. And at this point, I have to say, you know, given that there is another pass, like there's at least one other choice out there, I think a lot of people are going to make that decision. You know, I mean, maybe they're just as bad, but right now I think there's a pretty bad taste in everyone's mouth about Vail.
So do you think skiers will let their Vail pass go away and get a pass from one of the other mountains and plan a different kind of vacation next year?
I don't see why not. I mean, for us, we can ski, you know, anywhere in the Northeast and anywhere out there. Like, why do you have to be locked into Epic? You know, I mean, it was a great deal because there are mountains here that are also Epic mountains. But if they're going to treat people like this, you have to think twice about whether you want to do business with people who operate this way.
So once this strike began, and we know the conditions on the mountain were difficult, not only because of the strike, but lack of snow, what is your view of the communication strategy deployed by Vail, or lack thereof, at that time?
No, I don't think they had any communications that I could find, except, you know, the leaked communications and the one about how we've already raised their rates and, you know, more than 50% over the last four seasons, which made me even more upset, to be honest with you. I think during union negotiations, you know, this is the kind of stuff that we used to teach a lot earlier in my career when unions were a bigger deal before Ronald Reagan busted the, you know, the air traffic controllers. You need to be transparent and honest about what's going on. Get the best information out to people, outline the company's position. You want to have open channels of communication with everyone so that employees can ask questions through multiple channels. You want to show respect and empathy for them, acknowledge their concern, and say, you know, we're doing the best that we can. We all have to be able to get through this. You don't want to have inflammatory language of the kind that they have. You want to collaborate with the union reps, find common ground. And then the most important thing is to train your managers and leaders so they can do a good job talking about sensitive topics like this without appearing dismissive or combative or coming at it from a legal perspective. Managers have to have the tools to be able to answer questions transparently and stay aligned with whatever the company messaging is. And look, we know that companies have to make money. There's no question about that. But when you see this amount of money and you find out that's what they're paying people, I think very few people are going to be sympathetic to the company. And they could have used a polling company like Morning Consult to figure out what people actually think and have realized this was in the atmosphere already. They did none of that, as far as I can tell.
Again, it's not like we saw, you know, a face of the company being proactive on even the local media, right, trying to explain, look, this is how we're trying. And again, that's something that I assume you would advise, right? You really have to get you have to have a spokesperson out there and somebody who is sort of expressing positive things. You know, the other thing I wanted to ask you about is, in situations like this, I was thinking, you know, why weren't they handing out free soda, free hot chocolate, or hiring acrobats and clowns? You know, doing something I mean, have you seen other companies do things like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it happens all the time. You have people waiting in line. I mean, I was in a line I'm trying to think where we were in line, and somebody did that. They were passing out, you know, gifts to you to try to make you feel better. It's a common practice, but, you know, really what you want to be doing is maintaining regular updates to people, making sure people feel like they're safe and things are orderly. You want to maintain, you know, make sure that people understand that you really have a commitment to kind of get this resolved. And I think, as we're talking about right now, customers need to understand what the potential impact on service is and come up with solutions and alternatives of the kind that we talked about before, where you say we have a lot of other mountains where you can ski. And they obviously don't have a good public relations or communications team, either in-house or that they hire in, to explain the company's perspective without vilifying workers or the union. I mean, they must be just completely winging it. And if they do have a communications person or an outside agency, they did a terrible job and should be fired.
Well, yeah. Yeah, it almost sounds like their communication strategy itself was one of defense. Let's backpedal and cover it as it goes. It almost sounds that way.
And in the end, you know you're going, I mean, don't you know you're going to pay $2? They should have paid them the $7 they asked for, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, $28 for what those people do doesn't strike me as a ridiculous amount of money. And I mean, no, there's not going to be a whole lot of empathy for the company when they're not making their case for why they can't do that. It just seems like they're greedy and want to make more money for themselves, which may not be true. But how would we know, given how little communication we get from them? We don't know anything about their long-term goals. We don't know their understanding about how they want to create a positive work environment going forward. None of that. We have no idea what's going on.
Now, do you think this is something across corporate America, that they're letting the public relations side kind of, or public communication side kind of falter a bit? I've seen a little bit of that around.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, good.
I mean, I think there are a lot of good communication strategies and companies who have good communicators on board, managers who understand the importance of communication. You know, I've been teaching for 4 decades, and by now I would have thought it would be a whole lot better than it is, but it's way better than it was, you know, 40 years ago. And I'd say the appreciation and understanding of communication has grown dramatically. One thing I can tell you is that what typically happens after a situation like this is they get religion pretty quickly and will hire someone or hire a team. But they need help, and they need that help fast. And if they're getting it, they need to get rid of whoever has been doing that and call someone who can figure out how to communicate properly.
So if the senior Vail executives listening to this broadcast pick up the phone and call you and your phone rings and they say help, what kinds of things are you going to be talking about doing now? In other words, we talked about what they did before. We talked about what they did during. We're in the after period. One thing I have to point out is we here at KPCW we're trying to get, you know, a spokesperson from Vail to come out and talk about this. And so far, they haven't made anybody available. That is, as of the recording of this interview on January 15th. So if your phone rings, what are you going to tell them?
I mean, the first thing I would tell them is to apologize and apologize profusely to their customers about what happened and say, you know, we screwed up. We should have handled this differently. We should have handled both the negotiations differently, and we should have handled our customer relations in a tricky time differently. And, you know, that's the first and most important rule of crisis communication. And I do believe this is a crisis for Vail. Second, what you want to do is say, this is what we're doing to fix the situation. We're going to continue to work with our employees to try to make it better for them. This won't be the last raise we give them. And, you know, we have to work with the union, so it's a little bit tricky. It's not like we're dealing directly with our own employees. But I can assure you, we will not let this happen again. We'll do everything in our power to make sure it does not happen again, and that we, the union, and we are on the same page to avoid that. And I think that's what people want. They want to know what you're doing to fix the situation and that it will never happen again. Because I have to tell you, it's only, whatever, 4 weeks away from when I'm going out there. And, you know, I don't feel good about it. I honestly don't. And I think a lot of people, I've talked to other people who are going at the same time, are a little bit worried about this and how the company treats its customers and its employees does not make you want to spend a lot of time on that mountain in the future, or any of their mountains for that matter.
Can we talk about, assuming that they don't adopt that kind of strategy, or even if they do, let's talk a little bit about the half-life of the reputational damage we're talking about here. Is this something that's going to plague them for a while? What's your take on what you've seen other companies experience with similar kinds of damage?
Look, I think that the reality is that people have pretty short memories. And if they had a minor effort to try to fix this, they could get beyond it pretty quickly. And in addition, you know, people who like to ski like to ski. People who have houses there aren't going to stop going. People who rented, you know, in the future are going to go. But the question is the next time, and this is as a customer, I can tell you, the next time I will have second thoughts. And I'm sure that's true for anybody going on vacation. I mean, it is possible that people didn't hear about this. But I have to say, this was widely reported. It was on NBC and NPR and a whole host of other places. You'd be hard-pressed not to have heard about this over the holidays. And given that, I do think it will have an effect on long-term relationships. And they need to fix that before it gets to that point. They really need to do something before they get there. And they have to have a different approach to communications overall going forward. If they can do that, it can get beyond this pretty quickly. If they don't, more things like this will continue to happen. And I think the union is going to be emboldened because they know that the empathy is on their side and not on the side of management. And that's going to have repercussions for the company.
Now, I know they have some resource they manage in the Southern Hemisphere, so they can almost try out a few ideas with some of those on this upcoming summer.
Yeah, they could. And I think that would go a long way towards helping them. But not doing anything strikes me as a very dangerous situation for them to be in. And as I said at the top of the broadcast, to me, the best way to avoid problems like this is to never let them happen. If you can do that, you know, you're not going to have any problem. They did allow it to happen. They allowed it to get worse than it needed to get. And as a result, I do think there are going to be some repercussions for them.
Yeah, it's almost like what we teach our kids in the schoolyard, you know, use your words. Just talk if there's something going on. And
that would be nice. I haven't heard a lot of words from them. I don't know if you have, but I haven't heard much.
Not at all.
We've been speaking with Professor Paul Argenti of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Thanks for spending so much time with us this morning.
You're very welcome.
We'll be right back after this.
Park City is known for a great variety of dining out experiences with cuisines from nearly every continent. We have a new choice that I don't remember being in town, Colombian. Joining us is Alejandra Laverde to tell us what we can expect from a visit to Encanto Restaurant. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning.
So Encanto, what's the translation into English?
Encanto in translation is like a enchanted.
Enchanted, good, like a charm.
Exactly. Yeah, charming.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah. And I understand this is your second restaurant. You have one down in Salt Lake?
Yes.
Cool. And it's a family affair.
Yes, exactly.
I like that. That is perfect. And how many other family members are involved?
We are four. It's my mom, my dad, and my brother.
Good.
And I. Yeah.
And how long has the family sort of pursued the restaurant business?
We start here in Park City with Burgers and Barley, just right before the pandemic.
Yeah.
And we start with that one, and then we wanted to bring to town something different, you know, something that is not here yet. And why not? Colombia has a lot of kind of food, flavors. Why not, you know?
Yeah, perfect. And I've never seen a Colombian restaurant in town, so that's great. So Colombia is a country of beaches, tropical beaches. We got the Andes Mountains. Is your food from a specific region or departamento?
Actually, we try to have a little bit of everything, you know, so you can find something from the coast, that is where the beaches and all the stuff. So it's tropical. Mm-hmm. And we find something from the center of the country, that is the capital, that is Bogota. and some of the it's different like departamentos, you know. So we are trying to pull a little bit of everything, so you can, you know, try something of our country.
Now, did any of your family have formal training in sort of cooking, or are this something that you just guys have come upon more naturally?
Yeah, it was more naturally. We don't have like any cuisine, like professional person, but we have like grandmas, you know.
And that's an important source of knowledge when it comes to cooking.
Exactly. So that is more like, you know, like it's super fresh, and we try to do everything as natural as possible. And, you know, like grandmas is the best teachers that we can have.
Well, since we're on food, what is your favorite item on the menu?
On the menu, I love patacones.
Okay.
Those are one of my favorites. The one with shrimp that we have is that one. Okay, we have like a steak and shrimp, but the shrimp is a tropical stuff. So it's from the coast of the country. And they use everything with coconut. So they have, like, you know, in my country, we have like coconut rice, coconut, and like with everything with coconut. So why not try that shrimp in our flavor with coconut and the plantain and everything. So it's really good.
So the term patacones, what does that mean? Tell us what the structure of the food is.
Okay, the patacones is a plantain.
Okay.
It's flat and it's fried, so it's crunchy. And we put the ingredients or the meats on top of the patacones. So, yeah. Those
and
are really
do you
good.
Eat it with a knife and fork, or just
normally? It depends. Normally, Colombian people eat with not like everything with hands, but it's like it's easier, you know. And because we have in the restaurant is in the line of the fast food, so a lot of stuff eat it with the hands, you know, like arepas. It's like I eat a burger, you know, the hamburger. So it's like a burger, the hot dog. So, but people can eat it with fork and knife too. Sometimes for me it's easier because with the hand because it's crunchy. So cut it with the knife is kind of hard. But
So you eat the whole thing. It's not like there's a skin on the bottom.
No, you eat the whole thing.
So what happened to the skin of the plantain? Is that peeled off?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Before you cook it.
Yes, of course.
Okay. I'm sorry to ask these questions that may seem so obvious to you, but neither of us. I don't know. Have you ever had a patacones, Kevin?
No, never.
Okay. So that seems like one good one. Tell us about the next item that you'd like to describe.
The other thing that is really popular and is the enchanted platter. That one is a platter that you can share, you know, like, okay, it's for one people or two, four, you know. And that have a sample, it's like a sample of everything in Colombia. So they have like a different kind of items, you know, like a steak, chicken, but in our flavors, you know, seasoned in the way that Colombian people normally does. And we have plantains, the green, the patacones, and we have the sweet plantains too, because we have like two, we can eat like two different kind of plantains, right? We have arepas, we have a chorizo, belly, pork belly or chicharron that we call it normally. So it's like a it's a sample of everything.
So that would come. I'd order. What is the name of it?
Enchanted platter.
Okay, enchanted platter. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you'd bring out a platter.
Yeah.
And how many different little components would it have?
It's like I think that is like eight.
Eight
or
different
nine.
Kinds of flavors. Wow.
Wow. I'm actually just went online and I'm looking at it on the computer here.
She didn't bring us one, Kevin. I mean,
no,
sorry
I know.
About that. Go ahead.
Now. So do you have anything for vegetarians or vegans?
Yes. For vegetarians, the plantains can be... Oh, no, sorry. Yeah, the plantains, we have the traditional plantains that comes just the plantains or the patacones, and that come with a Colombian salsa and guacamole. We have a vegetarian burger. We have arepa that is vegetarian. That is the Calima arepa. So that one... he's vegetarian too.
I want to talk us a little bit more about on the seafood options. We mentioned shrimp. What are the other kinds of things from the sea that you like to provide?
For now, we just start with the shrimp. We wanted to just try at the beginning with go step by step. So we have like a little bit like, you know, something with the shrimp, something with steak, something with chicken. And depends of how everything goes, we can, you know, get more plates with seafood and all the stuff. But at the beginning, we want to start like a, you know, like a little baby steps.
Perfect idea.
And shrimp, is shrimp a big sort of element of the Colombian diet? Do people really like to have shrimps?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Yeah.
And are they coming from the Caribbean or the Pacific? Because I know Colombia has the two beaches, right?
Yes, we have two beaches. I think that is from the Pacific.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, not that I would know if there's a difference between them. So the enchanted platter would be what someone could pop by there and say, I want to try a little bit of everything, and that would be it.
Exactly.
So, arepas rellenas. Mm-hmm. So, is rellenas?
Rellenas, yeah. Arepas rellenas, yes. Okay. That is a gluten-free option because the restaurant is like gluten-free. Like, mm-hmm. like 90% of the menu is gluten-free. And that comes stuffed with depend of the ingredient that do you want. So it could be chicken, could be veggies, could be beef, could be cheese, you know. So those are really, really good.
It could be what's on my diet for this afternoon. That's what it definitely could be. So we're coming close to time. Can you share with our listeners, where are you located exactly?
We are located in the Prospector area. The address is 1890 Bonanza Drive. The unit is 111. And yeah, we are in the Park City Plaza.
Gotcha. What else is over in that area?
So. We are beside Nosh, Chubasco, you know, like is that.
I think everyone knows that little area. Mm-hmm. Wonderful. And what are your hours? You open every day of the week?
Yes, we open every day. We open Sunday through Thursday from noon to 8 p.m. And Fridays and Saturdays, we open noon to 9.
Gotcha. And it's EncantoRestaurantUT.com?
Exactly.
Excellent. And can people make reservations or it's easy enough to just pop by?
Yeah. So you guys can do reservations or just walk-ins. We accept both.
Wonderful.